Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit givemysterious.fm. You're listening to episode 423 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where we look at mysteries from the twin perspectives of faith and reason. In this episode, we're talking about the strange saga of Mel's Hole. I'm Dom Bettinelli, and joining me today is Jimmy Akin. Hey, Jimmy.
Howdy, Dom.
Folks, be sure to stick around for the end of the episode, as we'll have your feedback on our recent episode number 412, The Erling Exorcism. But first, in February of 1997, a man calling himself Mel Waters phoned into the late-night radio show, Coast to Coast AM, with Art Bell. He said he had a hole on his property in central Washington that was at least 15 miles deep, a hole that wouldn't fill up no matter what he threw in it, that swallowed sound without an echo, and that had even brought a dead dog back to life. Over the next 5 years, his story would grow to include the U.S. government seizing his land, a forced relocation to Australia, a second bottomless pit in Nevada, and a strange seal-like animal pulled up from inside the hole. So, what's the story of Mel's Hole? Is there really a bottomless pit in central Washington? And how did one man and one phone call turn a piece of local folklore into a national modern myth? That's what we'll be talking about in this episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. So, Jimmy, where does today's mystery come from in the first place?
Well, it comes from a single radio show, Art Bell's Coast Coast AM. That was the dominant paranormal late-night radio show in the 1990s and 2000s. It was broadcast nationally to millions of listeners, and I was one of them. I remember hearing some of the original broadcasts about today's mystery. On February 21st, 1997, a man calling himself Mel Waters called in and described an extraordinary hole on his property. He also didn't call out of the blue. He sent Art a fax first. Art read the fax on the letter, and then he got Mel on the phone. Mel said that the hole was about 9 miles or 14 kilometers west of Ellensburg, Washington, at a place called or near a place called Manistash Ridge. And his story would unfold across four separate appearances on the show over the next 5 years.
Let's start at the beginning with Mel's very first interview on February 21st, 1997. What did that first call sound like?
Well, Art has just gotten Mel on a special Mel line that he'd set up for him. He didn't have a call screener, so he'd set up special lines and say, if you're this person or in this category, call this number. After reading Mel's fax on the air, you know, earlier in the broadcast, he set up the Mel line and invited Mel to call in. And here's how the conversation opens.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening and or good morning across this great land of ours and beyond, the island of Guam in the west, eastward to the Caribbean and the U.S. Virgin Islands, south into South America, north all the way to the pole, and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM, and I'm Art Bell.
Well, all right. I have got Mel on the line. No thanks to all the Mel imitators on the special Mel line. I finally picked up the phone during the newscast and called Mel's number, and he was just coming in. So I've got Mel on the line. Mel is the guy with the never-ending hole, and we're going to ask him about it here in a moment. And Mel, are you there?
Yes, I am.
First of all, Mel, thank you for answering. What are you doing up at this time of the morning?
Well, after I sent the fax, I'm living in town here now because we had a couple of our buildings out there cave in after the big snows that we had out here last month.
Oh, yes.
And so thereby goes some of the construction debris into the hole. So,
all right. When did you discover this hole?
Well, the hole has always been there. We've been out there for a couple of years now, and you know, the hole has been there since we've been there. It's been there since the previous owner was there, and the previous owner there was quite elderly, and I'd say he was there for a good 30, 40 years before we moved in.
So that's the setup. Mel's out on his property west of Ellensburg, and he's called Art because something very odd is going on with a hole on his land. Right away, Mel says that the hole has been there as long as he's owned the property and as long as the previous owner had it before him.
What did Mel say about how the hole had been used over the years?
Well, he says it was used as the neighborhood dump. Everyone in the area threw their trash into it. And he says that that's the detail that first made him wonder about the hole. Here's Mel describing it.
You know, we just take all, you know, we take all of our trash, rubbish, anything we have that we have to get rid of. We take it, throw it in the hole. Everyone's throwing their stuff in the hole. The people from around there throw all the stuff in the hole. I mean, it's just been going on for a long time. Well, you know, I got this thinking one day, how come this hole is not filling up? It must be an awfully deep hole.
That's a good thing to consider, sure, as you throw stuff in it for decades, literally.
And so, you know, I used to be a, I would say pretty close to a professional shark fisherman. So I had a couple of huge fishing reels, went out there and started letting the line down. I figure after one...
Did you weight the line?
Oh, yeah. There's, in fact, the original line is still down there. I've just been adding to the line and keeping track of how much line I have used. So I've not reeled it in.
And here's where the story gets its hook. You know, Mel decides to measure the hole. He says he's a former shark fisherman, and he has these huge fishing reels. So he ties a one-pound triangular weight to the line, and he starts letting it down into the hole, and he says he never reels it back in. He just keeps adding more line. Eventually, by his own account, he's let down 5,000-yard spools of fishing line until he's played out over 80,000 feet. That's 24,000 meters, or about 15 miles or 24 kilometers. And he says it's never touched bottom.
Did Mel try anything besides line and weight to figure out what was down there?
Yeah, he tried lifesavers, the candy lifesavers. The idea being that if the line ever hit water, so, you know, maybe so far down you wouldn't hear a splash, the lifesaver would melt. And so you could check and see if the line had encountered water at some level. And he says it's an old shark fishing trick from his shark fishing days. Here's how he describes it.
Did I hit water? So I sent down a roll of lifesavers.
Lifesavers?
Yeah. So when it hits the water, the lifesavers will dissolve.
That's true. Oh, I see. So very smart. So
yeah, it's an old shark fisherman's trick there. We used to send our bait out on a balloon attached to a roll of lifesavers, and the bait would go out into the ocean on the tide.
Yeah.
And then eventually the lifesavers would melt and the bait would fall to the bottom.
How does Art react when Mel first says the hole was over 80,000 feet deep?
Well, he starts to do the math out loud, you know, 5,280 feet to a mile, and he realizes Mel's hole is multiple miles deep. If you do the math, as I said, it would be more than 15 miles or 24 kilometers. Here's that exchange.
Well, 5,280 feet is a mile, so you really think you've got 80,000?
Yes. Yeah, I get the line in 5,000-yard spools. And so I've gone through that many.
Well, you have got a hole then that goes, well, you know, you can't say to the center of the earth, but you've got a hole that goes miles and miles and miles into the earth. I would think a university would be out there, boom, just like that.
Well, my wife does work for a local university here, and, you know, we've been talking to them about it, and one of the things is... they find it quite incredible that I've let that much line into the ground, but that's what I've been doing.
Now, just for scale, 80,000 feet would be more than twice as deep as the deepest hole humans have ever drilled. That would be the Kolyvan Super Deep Borehole in Russia, which got to over 40,000 feet or 12,000 meters. The other striking thing about Mel's description is that the hole has an artificial edge to it. Mel says it doesn't look natural at all up at ground level. It's lined with stone for the first 15 feet and then turns into earth and then rock. Here's Mel describing it.
So, what do you got any guesses?
I have no idea. I thought it could have been a mine shaft, but the thing about it is the surface part of it's been very well cared for. I mean, someone built a very lovely wall around it. And
all right, tell me about the nature of the side of the walls. In other words, you must be able to look down far enough, at least to examine the side of the wall.
Sure. It's stone for about 15 feet down.
Yeah.
And then after that, it, you know, it's you know, soil, dirt, and then, you know, further down, rock. You know, it's a retaining wall. I'd say it's about a three and a half foot retaining wall, and it goes down about 15 feet.
So he says it's ringed by a stone retaining wall 3 feet to 3.5 feet high. And the wall continues down inside the hole for about 15 feet before turning to earth and then rock. And he says, in spite of everything that's been thrown into the hole, the local wells, you know, water wells, still have perfectly pure water.
Are there other strange things Mel notices about the hole, even in the first phone call?
Yeah, and two of them stand out. He says that there's no echo when you yell into it. And he says that his dogs won't go anywhere near it. They dig their feet in if he tries to bring them on a leash. Here's how Mel describes both.
Have you ever heard anything coming from any sounds or anything?
Well, you know, I mean, the normal thing to do is kind of like yell into it there, to, you know, to see an echo. And I've never heard an echo come out of that thing.
No echo.
At all. You know, that's one of the first things I noticed about it. As usual, I brought the dogs with me. They wouldn't go anywhere near the damn thing, and I went back to the Suburban and hung out over there. So it was kind of if I try to bring them there on a leash, they'll just dig their feet, and they do not want to go anywhere near the hole.
Okay, so there's some really strange stuff going on with this hole, and Mel's dogs aren't the only ones in our mystery. There's also a story about a dog that belonged to one of Mel's neighbors. What happened there?
Mel says that a neighbor of his threw a dead dog. It was his dog, but it had died. Threw his dead dog into the hole and later saw the same dog alive again in the woods. Mel is careful to attribute this story to a neighbor, not himself. And here's how he describes it.
This could be an apocryphal story, but one guy claims that he threw his departed canine down into the hole.
Oh, really?
And he swears, well, the story is the guy that did it swears the dog actually came back to him. And he was
really?
He was a hunter. Apparently, the story is that he was a hunter, and he was out there hunting, and he saw the same dog. He had the same collar. He had the same little, little metal thing on his collar there. And he said it was the same dog. And he says he knew he threw the dog into the hole. But
well,
that's not my dog. That's not my.
It's not your story, but it's a story of a resurrected dog.
Yeah.
And Mel quickly says that there's a Native American angle to all this. He says that it's all Native American land around there. He wonders out loud whether there's anything in tribal tradition about the hole. And he says that the local tribes apparently know about it, but won't talk about it that much.
What did Art and Mel do at the end of that first call?
Mostly, they speculated about how to investigate the hole. For example, Art suggested lowering a person down with a camera in a cage. And it's understandable that Art would want to see the hole investigated. You know, at this point, Mel has only given Art a fax and a few hours on the phone. There's no location, no photograph, no secondary witnesses to bring on the air. And that was the whole story until 3 days later.
What happened next?
On February 24th, 1997, 3 nights after the first call, Mel was back on Art's show. First, though, Art read from 2 faxes that Mel had sent. The first was the initial fax that had led to Mel's first appearance, and the second was a follow-up fax, which is what we're going to focus on here. Art opens the second broadcast by promising listeners an update on Mel's hole. Here's how he leads in, including the moment that he reads the hole's dimensions from Mel's original facts.
Now, here again, Art Bell.
Hey, you're about to get an update on Mel's hole. We'll tell you all about that in a moment. It may be the deepest hole anywhere in the ground. It may go on forever, for all we know. I'll catch you up here in a moment. I received the following facts last week. Dear Art, I'm writing to you to see if I can get some help from you or your vast listening audience. I live in rural eastern Washington near the Menastash Ridge. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly now. On our property, there is a hole. Like the previous owners and the owners before them, we've been throwing our trash into the hole. Apparently, the hole has been there as long as anyone can remember. At first, I thought it was an ancient well. Anyway, the hole is 9 feet, 9 inches in diameter. There is a stone retaining wall around it, and we've put a steel door on top to keep anyone from falling into it. As I said earlier, people have been throwing their trash into the well, that's in quotes here, for decades. Furniture, household trash, dead cows, building debris, you name it. The thing is, I noticed the hole never filled up, so I got curious, actually obsessed, began trying to measure the depth of the hole.
So now we have an official width on this thing, 9 feet, 9 inches across, or about 3 meters. But Art keeps reading because the facts doesn't stop with the dimensions. Mel had listed several other things he found out about the hole, and he wrapped up his facts with a question for Art's audience.
There's nothing else particularly strange about it except for two other things. Dogs refuse to get within 100 feet of the hole. Birds won't sit on the retaining wall or metal door. Another strange thing is there's no echo when you yell into the hole. Indeed, I've never heard anything hit bottom when tossed in. We once tossed in an old refrigerator, and we never heard it hit bottom, no crash, splash, or crunch. I hope your listeners can help with possible explanations. I'm wondering if this, based on my measurements thus far, might be the deepest hole on Earth. Signed, Mel Waters.
And it's in this second interview that things start to get much weirder, because between the first call and the second call, Mel says men in yellow hazmat-style gear showed up on his property. He says there were armed soldiers, vehicles he didn't recognize, and people who wouldn't identify themselves.
What did Mel say about the people who showed up?
He says they cordoned off the area around the hole. Some were in hazmat gear, others were armed soldiers in plain dress. Here's Art's reading from Mel's follow-up facts when he hits the moment Mel describes when one of them came up to his vehicle.
When I got there, my access road was blocked by military personnel that were armed. I noticed that several pieces of yellow gear had entered and exited my property based on the direction of their tread. I asked one of the guards, what's going on? He said there was a plane crash on the property. I said, well, that's strange. I told him there's no smoke. I don't see any in the distance. He asked who I was, and I let him know I own the property. I then asked to talk to the officer in charge. A non-uniformed man came up to my Suburban and let me know that I won't have access to my property until the crash has been completely investigated. I mentioned the yellow gear and the lack of smoke, and that they were on my property. I was told by this man that it's not necessarily my property, and that it would be very easy to find a drug lab on my property. Well, I got the drift. I asked if I could leave. He said, sure, don't come back until we contact you. I asked if he wanted a way to contact me. He said, they know how to contact me. I said, I suppose you don't want me to talk to anybody about this. He said, nobody would believe it anyway.
So Mel says the men threatened him, specifically that if he didn't cooperate, they'd find a drug lab on his property and make sure he went away for it. But that wasn't the only thing that Mel's facts described. He also passed along a story from one of Mel's neighbors. A neighbor told Mel about driving up to the hole in the dark before there was a cover on it, and he says he saw something coming out of the hole. Here's what Mel said.
Oh, I talked to one of my neighbors earlier today, and he told me something very interesting. He said that some time ago, he was driving up to the hole at night and thought he saw the most bizarre thing. he said he saw a beam of solid black coming out of the then uncovered hole. I said, what do you mean? He said he saw something blacker than black coming out of the hole, like a searchlight reaching into the sky as far as he could see.
So a neighbor saw a beam of black light or something that looked like that coming up out of the hole. Also, Mel said that transistor radios brought to the edge of the hole started playing programs from decades earlier. Mel also appears by phone in this episode, though here we're focusing on his faxes. And then after this interview, Mel goes quiet for almost 3 years.
What about the third show where Art discussed Mel's hole in April of the year 2000?
By April 24th of 2000, the audience knew the basic story, and when Mel came on again, he had new details. Art uses this third interview to review and confirm the core claims, you know, like the 80,000 feet depth, the dead dog, the trash thrown in. Here's some of that exchange.
Based on what your caller said, this line will break at... probably at the top of the line, because that's where all the pressure will be. So,
but you believe you're down 80,000 feet?
Yeah. Yeah, without a doubt.
80,000 feet?
Eight with, what is that, four zeros on there?
Well, those are miles, 5,280 feet. So
yeah,
you can figure
that's,
from there.
Someone, I believe, I haven't done the math on there. I always forget how long a mile is. But
how long have you owned this property with a hole?
We've had the property for about 4 years now, and... you know, the guy that had it there had been there for a long time. I believe he'd been there for over 40 years. It's very rustic. I think I might have indicated to you, we do not have electricity there. We do not have phone service.
So according to Mel, he had the property for about 4 years in the year 2000, meaning that he'd bought it around 1996, about a year before the first phone call. And the previous owner had owned it for over 40 years, meaning that he bought it around 1956 or earlier. Those details will be important later on. Mel also has a completely new chapter to add. He says he's been in Australia, and he says that he was relocated there by the federal government as part of the deal that gave them access to his property. Here's what he says.
And, you know, I had agreed for them to let me relocate in Australia, a place that I love and actually wish I can go back to, but that's neither here nor there.
Well, you did, in fact, go to Australia because I had a couple of emails from when you were there.
I would contact you from time to time there just to let you know I was okay.
And you were in Australia. Oh, I know that's true. So you had taken the money, and I figured you were probably sipping martinis in some nice Aussie outback location with lots of nice young Australian, and just having a nice life.
Combing my beard and all that stuff.
So according to Mel, between 1997 and 2000, the federal government bought him out, effectively. He says that they gave him a substantial annuity. An annuity meaning a fund that pays you out a certain amount of money every year. Mel turned over the property, or at least let them have access to it, and then he relocated to Australia, where he lived for a while very comfortably. He received several payments of $250,000 each, and at least according to some reports, they totaled around $3 million, which would be almost $6 million today after all the inflation the government has caused. And although Mel was doing very well in Australia, he came back to the U.S. in December of 1999. Part of the reason why was to help his nephew move from Tacoma to Olympia, Washington. And some really strange things happened on that visit. Mel explains.
We moved him down there in a U-Haul truck, and I was driving the truck back, and I was going to take the bus back to Olympia. There was some strangeness that occurred on the bus. There was an altercation. From what appeared to me, there were policemen and transit people that came over there. I was asked to give my statement. I said, no, I got to get back to Olympia, blah, blah, blah. I can't miss the last bus. They said, that's okay. You can talk to us. We'll drive you back in the van. That was the last thing I remembered. Because when I had woke up, it was about 12 days later, and I was in a real seedy part of San Francisco. lying in an alley. These winos were basically trying to get me to sing on the road again.
So Mel had been offered a ride back to Olympia in a van. Then there's this hole in his memory, and he woke up about 12 days later in an alley in San Francisco. Art then pressed Mel about what happened with the money he had been paid, and Mel said that since he and his wife had divorced, he no longer had any claim on the land where the hole was, so he wasn't receiving any new payments in connection with it. And he had invested most of the money that he had received into doing research on wombats in Australia. But when he tried to access his remaining funds after he woke up in San Francisco, the money wasn't in his bank account, and he had to let go the people who were working for him on the wombat research. Then they move back to the story of Mel waking up in San Francisco, and it turned out that he was missing some teeth, some molars from the back of his mouth.
So there I am, you know, lying in the gutter, no teeth. I could still see the tape on my arms where they had taped down an IV or some sort of thing to it. So I was out of it for the longest time. And I contacted my nephew, and he managed to get me a bus ticket back north.
The significant portion of this is that Mel could see where an IV had been taped to his arms, so he had apparently been drugged in the 12 days that were missing from his memory, which raises all kinds of questions about who drugged him and why, since the last people he had a clear memory of talking to were the police and some transit people. And he also knew that there was government interest in his case, since the government had been, you know, paying him for access to the hole on his property and to have him relocate to Australia. When he woke up in the alley, Mel also discovered that his custom-made belt buckle had been stolen. Now, Mel was a craftsman who made and sold belt buckles, and he was wearing one that he had made himself. The buckle, of course, could have just been stolen by a wino who liked the way it looked, but there could also have been something more to it, because there was something very special about this buckle. Mel explains that it had three coins in it, that he had put the coins there to commemorate the 1945 Yalta Conference during World War II between Churchill, Stalin, and Roosevelt.
Basically, the motif on there is I had three coins, you know, that had affixed to it in bezels.
Right.
There was a coin with Winston Churchill on it. There was a coin with Joseph Stalin. And there was a coin, dime, with Franklin Roosevelt.
Rather distinctive, yes.
Well, this was folk art representing the great conference that they had.
Gotcha.
Yeah. You know. So we're looking at the coins there, and we're noticing there it is a 1943 Roosevelt dime.
Yeah.
Franklin Roosevelt was still alive in 1943.
And that's significant because in the United States, living presidents are not depicted on currency. Part of the reason for that is to avoid building up an atmosphere of monarchy or royalty around them. Well, Franklin Roosevelt died in 1945, and he wasn't depicted on currency until 1946. That was the year the first Roosevelt dime came out. So there never was a 1943 Roosevelt dime, at least not in our timeline. And this started people thinking that maybe Mel's hole had an interdimensional quality. Because Mel had found this coin on his property, you know, somewhere near the hole.
You know, on my property, you know, I'd cleared a land, you know, I found that Nazi sort of gun there. It was a P-38 that I gave to the landlord as a deposit.
I recall, yes.
And we dig up all kinds of things, bits of metal and stuff like that. Well, I found when I went one time I was digging around there and just rooting around, I found one of these red Chinese lucky money envelopes. You know, the kind of Chinese give it to each other on New Year's?
Yes.
And it had 10 of these dimes in it. So I got 10 dimes. You know, I'm making, you know, these belt buckles. I put one in each one there. So we're examining this dime here with this fellow in Ellensburg, and it struck us at the same time. I mean, when I told you 1943 Roosevelt dime, you thought, okay, well, you know, it couldn't exist. We had a dime that there's no way it could exist.
Right.
There was also something else strange about the dime, because it had a very distinctive mark for the mint at which it was made. If you look at a coin, you'll see a letter of the alphabet that stands for the name of the city where the mint was located. Like, for example, if you look at a coin and you see a D on it, that means it was made at the Denver Mint. But Mel's dimes had something unexpected.
But it looked just like your normal dime, but from 1943. And the only other thing that was kind of peculiar about it was that it had a B, as in baby, mint mark on it. Now, we have S for San Francisco, P for Philadelphia, D for Denver.
Correct.
But I have no record anywhere of a B, as in baby.
Or Boston.
Boston. Could be Boston. I don't know what it was, but I know of no B mint mark on a dime.
So that would strengthen the possible interdimensional connection, since there is no Boston Mint in the United States. Although, there was one. In fact, the Boston Mint was the very first mint in what is now the United States, though it stopped minting coins in 1682, almost a century before we threw off the shackles of our former British overlords. No offense to our former British overlords. There are also no other mints in the U.S. that use the letter B. Mel had actually made several buckles like this, and he'd sold one of them to a guy that he knew. So once they discovered the 1943 Roosevelt dime, this happened.
But, you know, he took it to a coin dealer, and the coin dealer was just amazed. He had no, I mean, he couldn't even begin to grasp what he was holding in front of him. You know, he started telling him, I don't know, this could be a prototype.
Well, nothing explains it. I mean, time travel, what would explain?
But something created before Roosevelt would have even died. You know, when they created that dime, they went to, you know, they sped up the process to get a Roosevelt dime after he died. But there's nothing that explains it. The guy offered him a huge amount of money, the coin dealer. Here, I'm going to write you a very substantial check. You give me the dime. The guy says, let me think about it, okay? I'll give you my number. You give me a call, and, you know, and I'll let you know what I think. And to make a long story short, a day or two later, this guy is visited by Treasury officials there who said they have to confiscate this coin from him for some legal reason or another, so they took the coin away from this.
Should have made the deal the day before.
He should.
So the Treasury Department officials took the coin, and that could have been why Mel's own buckle had been taken, too.
What about Mel's last appearance on the show?
That was in January of 2002. Art opens it by walking the audience through everything that's happened with Mel since 1997, and then once Mel comes on the air, he tells Art about a new hole in Nevada. He says that after he got back from the Australia relocation effort, he came through Nevada and stumbled on this new hole. He says it's on Bureau of Land Management, or BLM land, not private property this time, and it's also about 9 feet across, like the first one. Here's how Mel describes what the new hole looked like up close.
Okay, you're walking up to it, and what you see sticking out of the ground is the hole itself is the same dimension as the one in Ellsberg. It's
wow.
Wide.
9 feet in diameter?
9 feet in diameter. This one had a metal collar around it.
A metal collar?
Metal, solid metal collar.
That rose from how?
2 feet high and about 2 feet deep. But the Basque tell me that this property or this hole here has been there for all of their experience, and they have been there since the 1800s, just the way it is, but the same hole. On not their land. They don't own this land, Art. This is probably government, U.S. government land.
Well, the majority of land here in Nevada is BLM.
Well, exactly.
We'll come back to who the Basque are. But it's after this that Art frames the new development for the audience by saying,
Mel Waters is my guest, and we're beginning to hear about a second hole, oh my goodness, right here in Nevada. Mel is connected with Native Americans here in my state in Nevada and the Basques, and they've led him to this second well. covered with metal. It's got a metal collar all the way around it. And get this, folks, going all the way down inside the well, the metal continues far as the eye can see. Hole is 9 feet in diameter. And as far as you can see, the metal continues down.
And it's in this 2002 appearance that Mel's story takes a new turn, because at the new Nevada hole, he says he and some friends decided to actually try the experiment that Art had suggested back in 1997. They're going to lower instruments down into the hole, and then they're going to send something living down to see what happens.
What experiment does Mel say they ran first?
He says they ran a control experiment with ice. They put one bucket of ice on the surface and then lowered an identical bucket of ice down the hole on a rope. Then they pulled up the lowered bucket, and the ice in it, Mel says, was behaving very strangely. Here's how he describes it.
The first thing that we did is we had a whole bunch of Safeway or 7-Eleven bags of ice.
Uh-huh.
You know, the kind that you buy, you know, and we had a couple bags of that. So we had put one in a bucket on the surface, and we lowered another bucket of ice into the hole, 1,500 feet.
1,500 feet?
Yeah, we had access to a nice winch and about that much. We only had 1,500 feet of line, and that's what we...
What was the idea of lowering ice into it?
Well, first of all, you know, my curiosity is that I wanted to know... Was it hot or cold down there?
Okay.
So we basically waited for the ice to melt about halfway on the surface, and then we would hoist up the...
I see. So you had test ice on the surface.
Yeah. And so we lowered it down there. We waited for the ice to melt on the surface there, and it got about half melty, you know. So it was sitting in a bowl of... in a bucket of water with a few bits of ice floating around. We brought it up. And the ice in the bucket did not melt.
It didn't melt.
It was not melted.
So the ice they lowered in didn't melt the way the ice in the control bucket on the surface did. When they pull it back up, Mel says the ice that they lowered gives off what he calls eternal heat. It has heat coming out of it, but it still stays ice.
And what did they do with the bucket after they pulled it back up?
He says they put it on a cooking fire to see what would happen, and he says the ice still didn't melt. Instead, it started to give off heat. Here's how he describes it.
But we said, okay, what we'll do here is we'll take this bucket and we'll stick it on the fire. And we had a little place to cook there. Stick the
bucket with the unmelted ice?
Unmelted ice.
You put on a fire?
We put it on, like, our cooking fire there. And the ice catches fire.
What?
The cubes catch fire. And I guess maybe catching fire might be the wrong word. That the ice, we took it off the fire right away. And so we set it on the dirt. And the stuff in the bucket was still burning. And again, burning might not be the right thing. It was giving off heat.
Was there a flame?
It was not so much a flame as a kind of have you ever used a gas stove?
Sure.
Okay. It was like the barest turning a gas stove on. It was like it was glowing like that last flicker before you turn it off completely. That's what it was like around all the... One guy took some of the stuff home. He put it in his wood stove. The thing has been keeping his place warm.
Yeah, northern Nevada is very cold.
So
this is like giving off eternal heat?
Then they tried the next step, lowering live animals.
And what did Mel say happened when they lowered something alive into the new hole?
Well, they didn't lower a person down, which is really good because you never experiment with humans until you've proved something is safe using animal testing. Mel said they lowered a sheep down into the hole on a rope and then pulled it back up. When they got it back to the surface, the sheep was intact on the outside, but its internal organs were just gone. Here's how Mel describes it.
So he started cutting into the sheep, and it looked like the sheep had been cooked. It was the flesh was hot underneath, you know, when he started cutting through the sheep here, it looked like the sheep had been cooked.
Oh, my.
We got the sheep on this table that we, you know, just eat that. And, you know, this guy's cutting the sheep open here. And he gets it so he can look inside and see the internal organs like he's going to eviscerate the sheep.
Right.
Except they're not what we expected.
What do you mean?
It looks like there was gel in the cavity there. And something that looked like this huge tumor. And almost taking up the entire length of the body cavity. The heart, the lungs, whatever parts the sheep comes with, they weren't there.
But then they found something really strange inside the tumor that was inside the sheep. What was that?
Mel says that they found something living inside it, something with the body shape of a small seal. Here's how he describes the creature.
And inside this tumor is what it appeared to be a fetal seal. Like, you know, like...
A fetal what?
Seal, like a pinniped, a thing that lives in the ocean that
yes.
balances balls on his nose.
Yes.
It's about 18 inches long. You know, it's got the flippers on it. And it looks like a little seal.
Oh,
you know, it looks
God.
Just like your basically your little seal, except it had what, and I don't know, I don't want people to freak out, but it had what looked to me like human eyes. Like, you know, a human being.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what, like, cat eyes look like.
Oh, yeah.
You know what dog eyes look like.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what seal eyes look like, but I know what human eyes look like.
Sure you do.
And this thing looks like it had human eyes. And the thing was alive, but it was connected to the tumor, like with this umbilical cord.
Holy mackerel, Mel.
And we could see the seal moving his eyes, and it was... And I'm calling it a seal, okay, but I have no idea what the heck this thing is, okay? I'm calling it a seal. But it's opening his eyes, it's closing, the flippers are moving, it's still in connected to its tumor there.
It would be really weird to cut into a sheep and find this tiny creature inside. How did Mel and the men with him react?
Well, Mel says that the creature moved a little, and then it separated from the tumor on its own. He says everyone stood back watching it, and he says that he felt something that he didn't know how to name.
And it moved about a little on the table.
Yeah.
You know, so we're all standing back at that point because this thing is loose, you know.
I'll be way back.
And you know, we're watching this seal. Well, I just felt I was in the presence of something extraordinary, something beyond extraordinary, something like, I don't know. I'm not a religious man, but it felt in that category of having a religious thing there. This was just such a stunning thing to witness.
Well, something that far from our understanding would appear to be magic or religion or whatever you want to call it, I'm sure. Yeah, so what did what God's name happened to this thing?
Well, we left it there, and it began to, you know, it just kind of looked at us there, and, one of the Basques suggested we kill it, you know, and, you know, just kind of club it, and unfortunately, and...
is that what they did?
No, basically cooler heads prevailed. The thing was moving around on a table, and it finally moved to the edge of the table.
Yeah.
Now, I go up to it at this point. It looked directly at me when I got up to it, and it seemed, you know, it seemed to have a contact with me. And I got this compelling feeling to pick it up and place it on the ground. And I did that. My hands were slimy from the seal, and I just moved my hands past my face before I decided to wipe them off on the rag at the table there.
Right.
And it smelled like ozone.
So that's really strange. The creature is alive, and by his account, it doesn't die. He says they try to kill it humanely, but they can't. They can't cut it, and a hacksaw blade won't cut it. Eventually, he says they bury it because they can't figure out what else to do with it.
Does Mel say anything else strange about the Nevada Hole?
Yeah, he says that he brought some plants from around the Nevada Hole and planted them on his Washington property, but he insists over Art's gentle probing that nothing he grew was psychedelic. And he mentions a Basque elder. We've already heard him mention the Basques a couple of times. The Basques are a people from northern Spain and southern France who speak, interestingly, a non-Indo-European language. You know, almost all the languages in Europe descend from the Indo-European root language and are part of the Indo-European family, but not the Basque language. The Basque language is what's known as a language isolate. It apparently predated the Indo-European languages that moved into the area. So it's a survival language from, you know, a very ancient times. And Mel refers to a Basque elder who's a sheep herder out in Nevada. Mel says that this man told him things about the hole that he found deeply moving, and he comes away convinced that the holes are sacred ancient places known to a few people for a very long time. And in the closing moments of his 2002 appearance, Mel says he's about to go off-grid. Here's how he begins to sign off.
But I'm going to be away from civilization for a good part of time, so it's going to be difficult. I'll probably give you another contact when I get back to some sort of civilization, probably from Nevada. But I probably will get in touch with you again.
Okay. By all means, Mel, please try and see if they will allow you, I mean, without identifying the area, just to get some kind of...
You just want like a photo?
Some kind of photographic evidence, okay. Yeah.
Now I'm going to be afraid that people are going to be scouring that terror server now that I get that out there.
Well, they probably will.
I want to bring the final thing, because we were talking about the Basque elder that I was talking to, and it was a very profound experience for me to talk with him. And though he was not that much older than me, I felt that he was a great deal older than me.
Wiser.
And the Basque gentleman also gave something to Mel.
Yes.
And he got tired, and he was going to retire for the night, and he took my hand, you know, to clasp it. And in my hand, he put something in my hand when he was leaving.
Yes.
And he closed my hand.
Yes.
And he just told me, put that away. So he said, put that away. So I just, put it in my pocket and sat around talking with his family. And someone said, aren't you going to look at what, you know, the great-grandfather gave you?
Uh-huh.
And I said, oh, okay. And so I take it out of my pocket, and it's a 1943 Roosevelt dime. They told me he had found a similar packet of Roosevelt dimes.
Oh, my God.
Up there in Nevada, Chinese red envelope, and they said, I said to him, you know how valuable this thing is? I said, you know what this would sell at a coin auction? They said, no, you have to have it. You need to have this.
Do you have it now?
I have it. It's in my hand as we speak.
How about a photograph of that, Mel?
If I can scan a 1943 dime,
yeah,
you will have it.
Or get somebody who's got a really good quality digital camera, go to the macro setting and take a very close photograph of
it. Close up. But
can you do that?
I will do everything I can to do that.
You know my email address, right?
Yes, we can do that. And but that's what he left me with. And he said to me that it was very, very, very important. Or they told me, because they finished the rest of it. Told me this is something I had to have. Now, I hadn't told them anything. In fact, outside the fellow in Ellensburg, no one else knew about the dimes and the red envelope. But he found one out there, and he had it for years. I think he had it since the 40s, to be honest with you, late 43.
Mel, all I can tell you is we are out of time. This was one hell of a story.
So, like Mel, the Basque gentleman had also found a red envelope with 1943 Roosevelt dimes near the second hole in Nevada. And even though Mel had not told the gentleman or his family about his own find, they thought that it was very important for Mel to have this. Mel said that he would try to get Art a scan or photo of the dime, but as you heard, they were out of time and had to end the conversation. And that's essentially the last thing Mel Waters has said on Art Bell's show. He went silent again, and this time so far, he hasn't come back.
And what happened after Mel went silent in 2002?
Two things mainly. The first is that listeners of the show decided to go looking for the hole. And in April of 2002, just a couple of months after Mel's last appearance, a group of about 30 listeners from across the country met up in Ellensburg. They had GPS units, metal detectors, and topographic maps, and they hiked up onto Manistash Ridge to find Mel's hole, but they didn't find anything. This expedition was led in part by a man named Gerald Osborne, better known by the name Red Elk. Red Elk describes himself as an intertribal medicine man. He says he'd personally visited the hole back in 1961. He says that the hole leads to an underground shadow government base where alien activity happens. Red Elk then came on Coast to Coast in September of 2008 to add his own chapter to the legend. He told the audience that the hole is real, but that it's been camouflaged by the government and can't be found anymore. He also warned people not to go looking for it. And as of 2012, a local newspaper, the Ellensburg Daily Record, did a 15-year retrospective on the legend. No one had ever produced photographic evidence of the hole or GPS coordinates for it or any document showing that Mel Waters had ever owned land in Kittitas County. And that's the story of Mel's hole from a single February 1997 phone call to a still unresolved piece of American folklore.
In a moment, we'll look at Mel's hole from the faith and reason perspectives, but first, we'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make this show possible, including Edward H., Ryan B., Martin G., Jacob S., and William W. Their generous donations at givemysterious.fm make it possible for us to continue Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and all the shows at StarQuest. More than 90% of our financial support comes from individual donors like you, and you can join them by visiting givemysterious.fm. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is also brought to you in part by Transformed, The Legend of Rising Eagle by Victor Rubio. If you enjoy epic adventures that explore the battle between good and evil, you'll want to check out this story inspired by the cultures of the Americas. The Legend of Rising Eagle follows a group of young heroes as they confront mysterious disappearances, dark forces, and a growing threat in their world. Blending action, folklore, and spiritual themes like courage, sacrifice, and the search for truth, it's a character-driven fantasy with a strong moral core. Available now on Amazon in ebook and paperback. And by Rosary Army, featuring award-winning Catholic podcasts, rosary resources, videos, and the School of Mary online community, prayer, and learning platform. Learn how to make them, pray them, and give them away while growing in your faith at rosaryarmy.com and schoolofmary.com. So, Jimmy, what theories are there about Mel's hole?
Well, there are basically two theories. First, that Mel's story is absolutely true, and that there really is such a hole on his property, as well as a second one in Nevada. The second theory is that this was all a hoax.
Okay, then what can we say about Mel's hole from the reason perspective?
Well, the reason perspective is pretty clear here, and I'm not going to drag this out, so we should just say it. There is no evidence that Mel's hole exists, and a lot of evidence that it doesn't. In other words, this was a hoax.
Let's walk through the problems with the story. I imagine there are several big ones. One of them is likely the sheer size of the hole, its depth.
Yeah, Mel's claim is that he let out at least 80,000 feet or 24,000 meters of fishing line without hitting the bottom, and that's more than 15 miles or 24 kilometers deep. For comparison, as we said, the deepest hole humans have ever drilled is the Kola Superdeep borehole in Russia. It reached about 40,000 feet or 12,000 meters, roughly half of Mel's claim, and that took 24 years and Soviet-era state engineering to do it. So, you know, if it took them that long with industrial backing. How did this thing get on Mel's property? The geologists who've been asked about Mel's claim are also unanimous that this kind of hole is just not possible. Geologist Jack Powell of the Washington State Department of Natural Resources told the Ellensburg Daily Record in 2012 that a hole of the kind Mel described simply cannot exist. Here's the precise quote.
Geologically and physically, it's not possible for a hole to be that deep. The hole would collapse into itself under the tremendous pressure and heat from the surrounding strata. Let's explore that a moment for listeners who wonder why you couldn't just keep having a deeper and deeper hole. Why would such a hole collapse?
Because at those depths, two things happen. First, the rock above the hole presses down on the rock around the hole with enormous pressure, and the walls of an unsupported 9-foot-wide hole would collapse inward. Second, the temperature inside the Earth rises with depth. At 80,000 feet, which, you know, about 15 miles down, you're actually well below the normal thickness of the continental crust in many places. Temperatures at that depth can exceed 1,300 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 700 degrees Celsius. Pat Pringle, another geologist at Washington's Department of Natural Resources, made the same point in 2002 about the fishing line. He pointed out that the heat alone would have snapped the line long before it reached anything like 80,000 feet. So even if there were a 15-mile-deep hole, Mel couldn't have measured it the way he said he did. And here's how the point was put in the Seattle Times in 2002.
Pat Pringle, a geologist with the State Department of Natural Resources, said the area's landscape, formed more than 12 million years ago by a volcanic lahar, makes a hole of such depth unlikely. He admitted that odd things exist in nature, but doubts a hole like Mel's is possible in the brittle volcanic rock near here. Even if it is, he's sure the heat of the earth would snap a fishing line long before it reached 80,000 feet. And what about the geology of the area itself? Could the local rock even support a hole like this?
No, and that's another red flag. The land around Manistash Ridge was formed by volcanic activity, specifically by a giant volcanic lahar, or mudflow, more than 12 million years ago. It's brittle volcanic rock, the kind that fractures easily. It's a kind of stone that would be terrible for a vertical shaft 15 miles deep. So both geologists who've commented on the hole agree on this same point. It can't be the kind of hole that Mel describes.
Let's talk about Mel himself, because there's a problem with him, too.
Yeah, and this is a big one. When the reporters in Kittitas County looked for any official trace of a person named Mel Waters, they couldn't find one. No property records, no voter rolls, no utility hookups, nothing in the records that would normally show a person like him living west of Ellensburg in the 1990s. And, you know, Mel never gave out a real address.
Couldn't you just chalk that up to Mel using a pseudonym when he was on Coast to Coast so that he wouldn't be beset by crazy people wanting to see the hole?
Oh, sure. I have no problem with the idea of Mel using a pseudonym for privacy reasons, but that doesn't mean that we can't verify if he lived in the area or that the hole existed, because Mel didn't just use a pseudonym. You know, he never sent Art any evidence for the hole or his other claims. He never produced photographs. He never produced a sample of anything from the hole, not a piece of stone, not a piece of the eternal heat ice, not the body of the seal-like creature, not a scan or a photo of the 1943 Roosevelt dime. Brian Dunning, who covered this case on his podcast Skeptoid, also pointed out,
enthusiasts of the hole have searched public records extensively and found nobody of that name living or voting or paying taxes in the area, found no unaccounted private property in the area, and found no property transfers that fit Mel's timeline of when he said he acquired the land.
And that's significant because even if Mel was using a pseudonym to protect his privacy, there should be property transfer documents under his real name. Remember, in 2000, he said that he'd owned the property for 4 years, so he bought it around 1996. And he said the previous owner had owned it for 40 years or more. So he bought it around 1956 or even earlier. And the local land records don't match those dates, no matter what names are on them. So that's another strike against his credibility. And frankly, if this wasn't a hoax, then it shouldn't be hard to figure out Mel's real name, because the story didn't involve just him. Remember, Mel said that his neighbors had been using the hole to dump their trash into, like the neighbor who threw the dead dog into it only for the dog to come back to life. And the people in the area had been dumping their trash into it for a long time. Art, you know, said it was literally decades, but even if Art was mistaken on that point, this was not just a story that involved Mel. There were a lot of other people in the area who knew about Mel and the hole. So even if Mel wanted to use a pseudonym on the air to protect his privacy, it should not have been hard for people to figure out who he was in real life or where the hole was, unless this was all a hoax.
And what about the 2002 expedition when they tried to find the hole?
Well, as you'd expect, they came up empty-handed. 30 people, GPS units, metal detectors, topographic maps, a physicist and a paranormal investigations team, and a local shaman who said he'd been to the hole in 1961, hiked Manistash Ridge for an afternoon and couldn't find any hole. The Seattle Times reporter who tagged along also noted that as soon as the search got hard, Red Elk shifted topics from finding the hole to lecturing the group about an inner Earth civilization with giant lizards that take human slaves for reproductive behavior. Here's how the Seattle Times reporter put it.
Up on the ridge, the search was bogging down. Red Elk had long since given up, preferring instead to lecture on a world called Inner Earth beneath the surface. With giant lizards that make sex slaves of humans, the place sounded a bit like the 1980s miniseries V.
What about the individual claims? The resurrected dog, the seal-like creature, the radios picking up old broadcasts?
Well, these are all Sherlock Holmes in the case of the missing evidence. Every one of them is the kind of story that you can't falsify. There are no documents, no physical samples. You know, take the resurrected dog. Mel doesn't even claim he saw it happen. He just repeats a story, says his neighbor told him about it, and he doesn't name the neighbor. The transistor radios picking up old broadcasts element is the same. It's a story Mel says he heard from someone else. And the seal-like creature that he says he did see only appears in the 2002 broadcast, 5 years after the original story, but he never produced a photograph, a body, or even a witness to the baby seal creature. By that point, Mel had already been on the air 3 times, so the audience, you know, would expect the story to escalate at each new appearance, and guess what? It did escalate at each new appearance.
And what about the dimensions? The hole is supposedly 9 feet, 9 inches across. That's very specific.
Well, specific numbers do make a story sound more plausible, but you got to ask, where did the numbers come from? And the answer is they only came from Mel. Nobody has independently measured the hole because nobody has independently even seen the hole.
So what do most people who've looked at this think actually happened?
The mainstream assessment from geologists and other investigators and from the local newspapers is this is just a hoax. Coast to Coast AM in the 1990s was, you know, notoriously friendly to imaginative callers. Art Bell would let people tell their stories at length and on the air. I mean, he had airtime to fill. And he didn't make great efforts to verify a caller's identity in advance. You know, I mean, what did he think he was doing? Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World? Well, geologist Jack Powell did point out something interesting, though. He said that there's probably a real old mine shaft somewhere on, you know, private property in the area, and that could be what gave the local legend its initial seed. Mel just borrowed an existing piece of folklore and then built it up and made it cosmic.
That doesn't mean it's not a fun story, though.
No, as Art Bell said, it's one heck of a story. It has a lot of fantastic elements that make for a good story. The depth, the lack of an echo, the resurrected dog, the eternal heat ice, the unkillable seal, the government takeover, the Australian relocation, and the 1943 Roosevelt dimes in red envelopes. And as long as you keep it in perspective as the fiction that it is, well, then it's okay to enjoy it as a story.
And now, what can we say about Mel's Hole from the faith perspective?
Oh, not a lot. Obviously, lion bad, so you shouldn't tell false stories with the intent to deceive people. Though, given how unbelievable this story is, it isn't fully clear that Mel was intending to really deceive people, certainly not in the long run. You could also read what he did as a kind of, you know, elaborate joke. However, I would mention that the Judeo-Christian tradition does have an element in it known as the abyss. The Greek word for abyss, abusos, just means bottomless. It comes from the roots a, which means not, and the word busos, which means bottom. So an abyss is something that's bottomless. Thus, in some English translations of the Bible, you'll read about the abyss or the bottomless pit. This idea appears in Second Temple era Jewish literature like First Enoch and Jubilees. We talked about First Enoch in episodes 323 and 324, and we talked about Jubilees in episode 319. We also talked about the Nephilim who show up in these stories in episode 386. In 1st Enoch and Jubilees, the angels who fell by mating with human women in Genesis 6 are then confined to the abyss, and it's where they'll stay confined until the last judgment, when they'll be transferred to the lake of fire. Thus, in Luke 8, the demons in the Gerasene demoniac beg Jesus not to send them into the abyss, but to let them go into the herd of pigs. We read,
"And the demons begged him not to command them to depart into the abyss."
And in Jude 6 we read,
"The angels who did not stay within their own position of authority, but left their proper dwelling, he has kept in eternal chains under gloomy darkness until the judgment of the great day."
Similarly, 2 Peter 2:4 says,
"God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into Tartarus, and committed them to chains of gloomy darkness to be kept until the judgment."
And in Revelation 9 we read,
"And the fifth angel blew his trumpet, and I saw a star fallen from heaven to earth, and he was given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit. He opened the shaft of the bottomless pit, and from the shaft rose smoke like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened with the smoke from the shaft. Then from the smoke came locusts on the earth, and they were given power like the power of scorpions of the earth."
And those locusts are symbols of the demons who were confined in the abyss. So we do find the image of a bottomless pit in the Judeo-Christian tradition, but this has nothing to do with Mel's Hole, because the biblical bottomless pit is an image used to symbolize a spiritual realm, not an actual physical location like Mel's Hole was supposed to be. So the inhabitants of Ellensburg, Washington, don't have to worry about demon locusts are going to come swarming out of the ground to get them.
So, Jimmy, what's your bottomless line?
Mel's Hole began as a single February 1997 phone call to Art Bell's Coast to Coast AM. It grew over four appearances across 5 years into an elaborate paranormal late night radio story. But every dramatic claim in the story comes from just one man, Mel himself, and the story is simply not credible. Geologists at the Washington State Department of Natural Resources have said that such a hole of the claimed depth is geologically impossible. It would collapse from pressure and heat, and that the fishing line Mel says he used to measure it would snap long before it reached the depths he describes. Local reporters could not find any record of a Mel Waters ever owning property in Kittitas County, Washington. And even if he used a pseudonym, Mel should have been found because of how many locals he said knew about the hole. A 2002 expedition of 30 people with GPS, metal detectors, and a guide who claimed to have seen the hole personally still came back empty-handed. Speaking from the reason perspective, this was a hoax, but that doesn't stop it from being a fun late night story.
And Jimmy, what further resources can we offer folks?
We'll have links to information about Mel's Hole from Wikipedia and Grokopedia, also an article from the Ellensburg Daily Record, one from the Seattle Times, the Skeptoid podcast, and if you want to hear all the original Mel Waters interviews in all their glory, we'll have a link to an archive of Mel on Coast to Coast, as well as his guest page at Coast to Coast AM.
And now we turn to our mysterious feedback brought to us by our feedback coordinator, Rob Leonardi. And as I said, this feedback comes from our episode number 412, The Erling Exorcism. The first feedback comes from Ray on Patreon, who writes, "If I understand the bottom line correctly, we can safely assume the woman is mentally ill while also being possessed only for a certain period and not constantly. Is that correct? If so, I wonder what is stopping the demon from acting as if she's just mentally ill to avoid being driven out. How can we decide if she's being possessed or presenting symptoms of mental illness?"
Well, it can be difficult to discern the border between mental illness and genuine possession. The sort of bright line test is anything paranormal happening? Because if it's just mental illness, then nothing genuinely paranormal happens. I would summarize what was proposed in the episode a little bit differently than you did. It is possible, and I think I alluded to this, that there was both mental illness and demonic possession in this case. But I think it's also possible it was all mental illness, or that there was demonic possession. I see there as being a range of possibilities here. It may have been all mental illness. It may have been some mental illness and some demonic possession, or it may have been just demonic possession. So I think there's a range here, and I wouldn't commit to just one of those.
Our next feedback comes from Elizabeth, who sent in an email. She writes, "I was just beginning to listen to this episode. I'm curious about the second source you mentioned. You read the disclaimer that the manuscript was meant to be kept private and not intended for circulation, but you used it anyway. Why did you not hold yourself to that standard? I realize you aren't preaching from the pulpit, but one could argue that podcasts are a form of journalism and therefore considered press."
Yeah, no, I'd agree that that podcasts are a form of journalism and could be considered a form of the press. So that would apply with the restriction that was on the secret manuscript. But the question is, what binding value does that restriction have? There's no church command. You know, there's no bishop's signature or dicasterial official from Rome saying, don't publish this. It's just a note that was put on the manuscript by the priest who authored it based on what Father Riesinger communicated to him. So it's just a private request. You know, it's like if I wrote a manuscript and said, don't publish this. Well, that wouldn't have any binding authority. It's basically just an instruction from me, a private individual. And so we had an instruction from a private individual here not to do this back in the 1930s. So this is 90 years ago, and all the people involved are dead. And since the story of the Erling exorcism is out there and people are still believing it and still taking it in a way that does not incorporate all the information that the secret manuscript sheds on it about here are all these false prophecies that have since been falsified. Well, I judged that there needs to be a counterbalance in the modern record saying, hey, we know more than they knew back in, you know, the 1930s. They made all these predictions. They've all been falsified, and you need to take that into account when you're evaluating this. So since this was only a private request and it was only by people who are no longer alive and therefore cannot be hurt or embarrassed by the material, and there is a public need for the material in the secret manuscript to be known so people can properly evaluate the Erling exorcism, I judged that I wasn't bound by that request, and B, there was a reason for going ahead and publicizing what's in the secret manuscript.
Our next feedback comes from Airbus320 on Discord, who writes, I've often wondered why the topic of demonic possession generates so much interest in Catholic circles. It is very rare and kind of a distraction from the more common ways that demons affect us. Our resentments toward one another are a far greater danger to us than possession.
I agree. I think that it's worth knowing about demonic possession and demonic possession cases, but I see a lot of people who are just too fascinated by this subject and have an unhealthy interest in it. That's why I don't cover it all the time on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. You might think, hey, it's a Catholic show about mysteries. You ought to be doing demonic possession all the time, but no, I'm not personally fascinated by that topic. And I'm not, even though I know I'd get a lot of clicks, I'd get a lot of traffic if I turned this show into demonic possession of the week. But I'm not interested in doing that. I'm interested in a broad engagement with all the mysteries in the world that don't just focus on this, which is rare and in the grand scheme of things is pretty minor.
All right. And that's all our feedback this time. And now it's time to hear from you. What are your theories about the strange saga of Mel's Hole? You can let us know by visiting our website at sqpn.com or the Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World Facebook page, sending us an email to feedback@mysterious.fm, sending a tweet to @mys_world, visiting the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/discord, or calling our Mysterious Feedback line at 619-738-4515. That's 619-738-4515.
And I want to say a special word of thanks to Oasis Studio 7 for the video and animation work in this episode. Check it out by going to youtube.com/Jimmy Akin. And while you're at my YouTube channel, be sure and do the YouTube things, you know, like, comment, hype, share the podcast with others, and be sure and subscribe. I'm trying to get to 200,000 subscribers. And you can help us get there. I'd love to have you as part of the Mysterious World family. When you subscribe, take the bell notification, tie it to fishing line, and threaten to lower it down into Mel's Hole unless it always notifies you when I have a new video.
All right. So, Jimmy, what's our next episode going to be about?
Well, this week we looked at Mel's Hole, which is pure fiction. But next week we're going to be looking at some holes that really do exist and are really huge. And nobody's sure why they were built. So next week we're going to be going back to 1800s Liverpool and look at the mysterious tunnels built by Joseph Williamson.
Folks, be sure to check out the Mysterious World bookstore at mysteriousworldstore.com for links to all the books and videos that Jimmy mentions in the show. Check out our new designs for Mysterious World t-shirts, mugs, and more in our merchandise shop at sqpn.com/merch. And you'll find links to Jimmy's resources from our discussion on our show notes at mysterious.fm/423. And remember, to help us continue to produce the podcast, please visit givemysterious.fm. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is also brought to you in part by The Grady Group, a Catholic company bringing financial clarity to their clients across the United States, using safe money options to produce reasonable rates of return for their clients. Learn more at GradyGroupInc.com. Until next time, Jimmy Akin, thank you for exploring with us our mysterious world.
Thanks, Dom.
And once again, I'm Dom Bettinelli. Thank you for listening to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on StarQuest.
If you've enjoyed Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, you'll also enjoy another StarQuest Network show, The Secrets of Stargate. Find it wherever you can find podcasts or at sqpn.com/Stargate.